You're listening to Amphibicast.
This episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by Grey Ghost Creations. Specializing in unique wildlife art for lovers of reptiles, amphibians, and arachnids, Grey Ghost Creations offers a wide variety of art prints, stickers, pins, necklaces, and more. To find more unique original art, be sure to visit Grey Ghost Creations on Etsy at www.greyghostcreations.etsy.com. Thank you for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm Dandrew Bates, your host. And this week I'm excited to have another return guest for a part two. You may remember Ben Baker from episode 160. We had a very interesting discussion about a whole host of topics, the hobby in the UK, frog farming coming from a zoo background. And the episode did phenomenally well. And Ben and I had talked a little bit towards the end about doing a follow-up to kind of flesh out some of the topics that we got into, but maybe get into some more detail. And one of the topics is going to be Mantella. I enjoy new content with regards to different species. Again, Mantella, I had one Mantella like 25 years ago. And it's an interesting genus. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about wild versus captive, different observations of both. And a couple other topics that we're going to get into. So I'm really looking forward to it. I know a lot of people reached out to me, really enjoyed Ben in 160. And if you haven't already caught that episode, I would encourage you to go back, listen to that first, and then check this one out as well. So other than that, real quick, just the usual stuff. Thank you to everybody for the support. 5-star reviews, they go a long way on your favorite podcast platform. Simplest way to say thank you, simplest way to say that you're enjoying the show is to just get, you know, nice 5-star review. And if you want to leave some nice comments, that's great as well. And if you want to support the show, check out the link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to the Patreon page. If you want to support the show, $5 a month tier will get you a shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And I've got links to the merch store, In-Situ Ecosystems discounts, and some other fun stuff in there as well. So check out the link tree for all the show notes. And of course, always check out the week's sponsor notes in the show notes as well. So, Ben, thank you so much for coming back to talk to me. I had a really great time with you last time. We had a great discussion, and I'm really happy because we're going to kind of continue that and pick up on a couple of topics that we really didn't get too into. But just for anybody who hadn't caught that episode, Ben, if you could just maybe reintroduce yourself, just kind of tell us where you are professionally now, where you're working, what you're working with, and then we'll kind of pick up where we left off.
Yes, it's great to be back. I work and sort of manage an online company called Fantastic Frogs in the UK. And we're a frog supplier. We supply, you know, plants, lots of plants, lots of equipment, lots and lots of dried seeds and leaf litter and all sorts of stuff. But we also have a very large collection of dendrobatid frogs, probably 200 plus vivariums, and everything from sort of Dendrobates auratus right the way through to Fuego histrionica or, you know, all sorts of large O's. We act as a distribution point or I guess we sort of organize the paperwork for Tesoros de Colombia imports in the UK. We also look at importing stuff from Europe and from European breeders just to keep the UK sort of hobby supplied and to establish our population as a sustainable breeding resource. And previous to that, though, I was 30 years working in the zoo industry, working with things like, you know, Tuatara and Komodo dragon, so quite diverse sort of collections. But I've always really been an amphibian geek, if I'm honest.
Tuatara, that's another. We didn't mention that. That's another we didn't discuss. I mean, real quick.
No, they're cool.
How did you end up with Tuatara, which is like the oddball out species? How did you?
Yeah, well, I think they came to Chester Zoo and they came there probably, thinking back now, it's probably way before I was there, it's probably 30 years ago, maybe even longer, that they got a group of Tuatara in from New Zealand, captive bred ones, bred in New Zealand and shipped over. And I think at the same time, I believe Berlin received some animals and so did San Diego. However, both, I think, San Diego and Berlin have had issues with their population, and Chester Zoo's didn't have the same issues. So 25 years after arrival, they finally started to reach sexual maturity. And miraculously, I guess, but well, I think it's just down to time. I say miraculously, it's probably down to time, but we managed to breed Tuatara for the first time outside of Australasia, I guess 5 years ago. And they've bred them a couple of times since. And there's now quite a large number of them in Chester, waiting to travel to other zoo collections who have been waiting for decades to have an opportunity. But yeah, crazy, crazy animals. Absolutely lovely things to work with, and a highlight, I would say, of my sort of my career, really.
I can only imagine. I've never seen one in real life.
They're weird. They're tough looking. Like they're just sort of more solid looking lizard than you'd first think. But yeah, they're great. They're really good characters as well. You know, the animals that we had were distinct. Some of them had distinct color patterns. Some of them had distinct sort of like injuries from when they were juveniles growing up. So lost, like, you know, one had lost a tail and they don't regrow their tails fully. And but they all had very different characters as well. So it's kind of an odd reptile to work with.
He is always what impressed me. I'm fascinated by species with long life cycles, like the Tuatara, and I think it was the Greenland shark, which doesn't reach maturity until I think it's something like 100 years old.
Yeah, that's the thing with these. I think we were all panicking. We were like, oh, you know, because they looked like they're adult Tuatara. They looked like they were adult Tuatara for 10, 15 years, but they didn't start really. They started laying eggs. Old females would lay eggs, but we never had any fertility. We wondered what we were doing wrong, and then we started getting it right. Except I kind of now think that perhaps they probably just weren't sexually mature. Like, it just takes a lot longer when you're a Tuatara and you live a 100+ years. There's no need to rush into things.
The goal, or that was just an unintended bonus?
Well, yeah, I think retrospectively, I don't think breeding was a goal. And oddly, there's no real need to, certainly from a conservation point of view. The zoos in New Zealand are doing perfectly well, keeping on top of a captive population that could be used as a reintroduction population. They're also doing great conservation work, making sure that the places that have got Tuatara, and certainly the offshore islands that have got sort of locality specific populations, are all sort of kept pest free, and they're working to get rid of rats and cats and all the rest of it. And they seem to have it pretty much sewn up. However, it'd be very hard in this day and age to justify exporting Tuatara from New Zealand on the grounds of a zoo wanting to exhibit them for an educational purpose. However, with Chester now breeding them, a population not within New Zealand, those animals are now probably in quite high demand for collections that want to show a full range of reptiles, really, because they're obviously such a unique animal. Anywhere that's got a really good reptile house could probably do with some Tuatara.
Now, how does that work from a zoo perspective when you have offspring of, I mean, there really isn't like a bar to set when it comes to Tuatara, because it's the only member of its clade. And to my knowledge, like you said, they're not doing particularly well outside of New Zealand. Can you just, what sort of red tape do you have to go through in order to get those offspring to either another location, like another zoo, or shipped out of the country? That must be a nightmare, right?
Well, yeah, I think it is. Like, you know, certainly we really wanted to get a new male, a second male, because at the zoo they only had a single male in the collection. I mean, it was really, you would really like to have got another one. So I think they'd been looking for another male for sort of 7 or 8 years, trying to organise the paperwork to get one from a zoo in New Zealand across to us, who've got a, you know, who had a proven track record of keeping them healthy. And that had taken 8 years and still hasn't happened. So that's like 11 years now. So 11 years of trying, and they still haven't managed to secure one coming from New Zealand to us. And then there's quite a lot of places that want the animals that were bred at Chester, but that's got to be approved. We have nothing really to do with it. The species is managed under a stud book based in Wellington Zoo in New Zealand, and it's entirely their decision. If they come back to us and say that we've got to send them to London Zoo, then we can probably ship them to London Zoo easy, because that's just a matter of, you know, 3 or 4 hours drive from Chester to London. If they need to go anywhere else, I know for certain that artists in Amsterdam were keen on them. Berlin have got animals but haven't got the right sex ratio or sexes, so I think they probably want some. But in the time I was there, we made no headway in working out logistically how to get them to the places that wanted them or needed them. But realistically, it's down to Wellington Zoo and the stud bookkeeper to organise it. So yeah, luckily not that much involvement from us, but certainly it's almost as slow as their growth rate, and their longevity is definitely going to be what we'll remember them for.
Now, is that just a gentleman's agreement, so to speak, where the two parties just agree that, all right, this is the protocols we're going to follow? Because when you think about it, I mean, this may sound kind of out there, but if you just were to say, no, we're sending them here anyway, what would happen?
I'm not really sure what would happen. I don't think that there would be a situation where they demand their tuataras back, although on paperwork they could. But to actually repatriate the tuataras from Chester back to New Zealand would be a nightmare, and there'd be much more risks in terms of the risk of disease transfer than would make it worthwhile. So I can't imagine they'd ever want them back. And actually, there's not that much that they could tell us off and tell us that we weren't allowed to be part of the stud book. But since we're the only animals outside of Australasia breeding anyway, it's not that much of a breeding project outside of it. So it is a kind of like a really an agreement. But at the same time, the zoo that, you know, Chester Zoo is a very established and very well respected zoo within the international zoo community. The negative damage it could do from that point of view is the sort of thing that might stop them, you know, getting giant pandas in the future, because they're not trustworthy with these sort of things. So it's definitely something that the zoo would just go with the advice of Wellington Zoo and the stud bookkeeper, and that tends to be the way with most of the stud books, really. But yeah, not sure how empty or not the threats would be. But yeah, certainly an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to go out there. It's just it's not like there's this universal global law that governs all these things. It's generally a cohesive thing that's based on input from people from different countries. And yes, I know a lot of countries also attribute a tremendous amount of cultural value to certain animals. And here in the U.S., we had pandas, which were on loan basically from China, and they just went back to China. And yeah, it's really just more like the concept of ownership kind of interests me. So I'm always curious about the human dynamic behind sort of loaning species outside of the country or outside of the area. It's just the political dynamics and whatnot. It interests me because it kind of brings animals in as a catalyst for two separate countries to interact in what is hopefully a positive situation. But at the same time, it's not like there's no master governing body that legally can say, all right, well, this is what you have to do, this is what you don't. But you make a good point about, obviously it wouldn't even be feasible to send anything back, but
yeah. Yeah, it's odd actually that Chester Zoo particularly seems to have quite a strong link with New Zealand, in that I think at the moment at Auckland Zoo there are at least three ex-members of staff from Chester Zoo that are working in Auckland now. Two of them are now, well, one of them's the CEO, the main director. The other one's the director of conservation and research. And then one of their senior keepers on the herp department used to work for me when I was at Chester. So we've got a link of sending staff there as well. So it's quite a strong link between the UK zoos and New Zealand now.
Yeah. Another thing is, insular species also interested me. I mean, New Zealand, and again, I hope nothing I'm saying is coming off as disparaging towards New Zealand. That's not my intent at all. I'm just kind of curious. I mean, some of the wildlife that was native to native to New Zealand. Oh, it's incredible. Moas and the bird life. I'm interested in islands where there's very, very vulnerable populations like New Zealand that have species of birds and whatnot. I mean, from what I mean, another interesting thing from what I know is there's, I think it's the golden bell frog from Australia. It's almost extinct in Australia, but it became invasive in New Zealand and now it's doing well in New Zealand. I'm interested in island dynamics too, because I mean, the UK is for all intents and purposes, a series of islands. New Zealand is a series of islands, being surrounded by on all sides by water creates an incredible boundary to keep species out and not necessarily have the dynamic that you would have on a continental issue like you would have with North America, South America. Are the policies in New Zealand more strict because of that? Like they want to maintain that level of security?
Yeah, I believe so. Certainly very, very, very switched on and actually very forward thinking, really. I think in a lot of places you'll find conservation organizations that are established that are not entirely interlinked with the government of the place where the species they're trying to work with are based. So you end up with sort of political sort of issues in terms of how conservation organizations can help. In New Zealand, they're very interlinked. There's a very good relationship. It's not just NGOs. It's also like the zoos in Wellington and Auckland are very integrated into the government sort of conservation view. And I'm definitely not the best person to speak to about it. And I can definitely point you in the direction of one of the guys that I used to work with at Chester, who's now conservation director at Auckland, and he's a mine of information, and actually is heading up some incredible conservation projects over there, and he'd probably be a great one to speak to and could definitely fill you in a little bit more than I can.
That would be very interesting. I'm fascinated with that corner of the world. I had one guest on a while back. I think it was Dean Jansen from Australia. And we had talked about some of the hobbyist dynamics and not being able to have anything other than native species in the permitting system. And just that corner of the world is just so unique and has so many different species. Right. I'd love to do an amphibian deep dive with species, or even anything in that section of the world.
Yeah, well, they're doing work with like tailed frogs and arching frogs and all sorts of stuff over there. So like some incredible sort of native species work that they're doing through Auckland Zoo. And so I don't want to sound like too much of an advert for them, but like they're definitely good guys. So I'll try and see whether we can organize something, because they do some great stuff.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be a dream come true interview. While we're talking about islands, Madagascar is another incredible island that has a very unique dynamic. It's has all these different climates and so many different unique species. And obviously mantellas are the convergent, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess the convergent equivalent of New World poison frogs. What was it like going to Madagascar and seeing these things in the wild?
I guess I became sort of I fell into a job working in a public aquarium, and they had a frog room. And when I started, we were building it, and the plan was it was going to have lots of dendrobatid frogs in it. And you've got 7 or 8 vivs on display to the public, all with poison frogs in it. And it was great, but it kind of felt like we were just like, you know, it was just pretty colours in boxes. There was no sort of substance to the display. And after a while, I sort of became quite interested in Mantellas, and we sort of removed some of the dendrobatid frogs and put some of the Mantellas in to talk about the fact that there's a sort of a convergent evolution sort of story and the sort of malarian sort of like colorations work in both dendrobates and Mantellas. And we talked a bit about that. And that was back in 98, I guess, 98, 99, that I started working with Mantellas and keeping Mantellas. And I always dreamed of getting to go to Madagascar, but never realistically thought I would ever go, because it seemed like it's too much of a dream. And then luckily my job at Chester Zoo allowed us to start working with an NGO in Madagascar, doing some assisting research into golden Mantella populations. And it involved a mark and recapture program where frogs were collected on a day on transects in the forest, and you'd catch them, and they needed to be marked in some way so that they could be released. And then when they were caught again, or when the next day came that you were catching them, you'd be able to tell which ones had already previously been caught and which ones hadn't. So you could start to get an idea of the size of the population. And that was where the zoo came in, because we had a degree of expertise in tattooing very, very small frogs using a visible injectable elastomer that glows under black light. So you'd inject this tiny, like absolutely tiny quantity through an absolutely tiny needle under the skin of the frog. It goes in as a liquid, so it fits around everything that's in the frog, so it doesn't push anything out of the way. And when it sets, it stays permanently under the skin. And when you wave a black light over the frog, an orange, yellow, green, or purple or pink marker would show up on their legs. So we went to Madagascar, and my boss went, I think, in 2014 or 2015 to start training the people at the NGO, which is an organization called Madagascar Vocage. And those guys were trained to do the tattooing, and we would go out and assist them and make sure that everything was going all right. And I went out, first of all, in 2015, after my boss had been out, as a second round to keep, to make sure that the skills were being taught correctly and everything was being done right. And it was incredible. I think I know people who'd been to Madagascar before on sort of ecotourist trips, and they'd been to national parks, and they'd come back saying how incredible and pristine these rainforests were, and how amazing all the animals were. And then my experience was that I landed in the middle of the night into the capital, because that's when the flights sort of landed. Staggered into a sort of a lovely little hotel in the capital, and the next morning would get up and get in a car and drive for 3 hours out of the capital to a place called Moromanga. Probably not 3 hours, less than that. And then we would then trek south of there into the forest to the reserve. And most of the journey from the capital out to Moromanga, and then Moromanga down to the reserve, is through altered habitat, where it's been replaced by eucalyptus forests, which they use for making charcoal. There's the famous rice paddy fields that you see photographs of, and there's very little natural world left out there that hasn't been altered in some way, shape or form. So you get these very tiny fragmented forests. And actually, I found a lot of the time there, in terms of looking at wildlife, thinking it's a miracle that some of these things have survived as long as they have, because there's so much going on and so much sort of historic damage to the habitats, and it's, you know, it's an inevitability as people try and sort of like get on with their life and survive in these sort of situations that habitats get damaged. But it's quite a sort of a stark difference to what I was expecting from people who'd been to the national parks and seen them. And I went to the national park, some of the national parks, and they are beautiful. And you know, there's lemurs everywhere and all sorts of stuff knocking around. But actually the areas we were in were quite heavily altered. Apart from the small sort of like forest region, it's known as Mangabey Protected Area. And it is an area where there was a large population of golden mantellas to the south of the distribution of golden mantellas on the eastern coast. So we were looking at a population down south. And then I think you've spoken to Devin Edmonds before.
Yes, yes.
Devin was working with the population that's farther to the north and of the range. So we were kind of at opposite ends to him. There's not that much population in between anymore. There used to be, I imagine, a contiguous habitat, but it's kind of gone. So they're sort of fragmented apart. So we were working with a southern population, and he was sort of working with a slightly more northern population. There isn't much. There's no real difference between them. There's probably some genetic, just for the amount of time they've been separated. But we used to get a lot of people, and you see it in some of the old books, where they say that the population in the north was a lighter colour than the ones in the south. And actually, some of the research that was being done whilst we were there sort of proves that that wasn't really the case. And that was kind of just a sort of a rumour or a myth, as it were. But the habitat itself is unusual. It's not as lush as a Central American rainforest, but it's at a slightly higher altitude. So we're up at around 800, 900 meters above sea level. And that seems to be their sort of like preferred sort of range at the moment. I guess global warming's having an effect on that and pushing them up the hill. But that seems to be where they live. And they're found around these sort of permanent and semi-permanent sort of pools that they cluster around during the breeding season, and then they distribute out into the forests out of season and return back to these ponds for breeding. And we would go just prior and at the start of the breeding season and monitor them daily at multiple sites throughout the forest throughout their breeding season, just to see how many would gather and what the sex ratios were, how big they were, how many of them we'd already caught before. And we went back certainly 2015, 16, 17, and 18. And the project finished in 2019 in terms of the study for the golden mantella population study. And then it's continued with trips from Chester Zoo taking people out to do habitat restoration work and monitoring, searching the forest for other amphibians and reptiles, because the little bright green mantella is nice and easy to see, but there's an awful lot of other Madagascan amphibians that are found there. So there was a sort of population surveys and all sorts have been done there, but it was kind of like incredible just to walk into a habitat where there's little orange frogs everywhere in a dark leafy forest, as it were. It's a cool thing.
I just want to back up real quick, because you said something earlier that piqued my interest. The tattooing. How do you develop that type of technology and apply it in this situation? Because it seems very, very niche. Is this some sort of technology that's used like broadly with amphibians? Was this specifically just designed for this one situation?
No, so it's designed for fish.
Really?
So, yeah, and in the, I think it's I want to use the term Pacific Northwest.
Yes.
I think it's a US company that developed the elastomer, and it's for fisheries monitoring. I think it was used a lot for monitoring a skate or a flatfish species, certainly, maybe a ray or a skate. And it's been going for decades. They use it a lot in fish. Probably not really been used in much as small as mantellas. But like Jersey Zoo, the Durrell organization in Jersey used it for marking tadpoles of Majorcan midwife toads. And the tadpoles get quite chunky. And I think maybe agile frogs as well. But certainly they've been using them for marking tadpoles for doing population studies in Durrell. And I think it sort of developed from there. I think I went to a course at Jersey Zoo where they showed the technique, and actually my boss who had started the project with the mantellas had started the training. He was from Jersey Zoo and he developed it there, so it is quite niche. I guess there's not that many people who've used it. I think it's been used in like a Spherodactylus gecko in sort of like northern South America as well. They've tried it and various other amphibians, but it doesn't work with all of them because not all of them have got see-through undersides, or at least translucent undersides. So, you know, a lot of bufonids, the skin is just too tough and it doesn't really work. Anything that's got a lot of black pigment, so a lot of dart frogs, it won't really work on. But mantellas, it's perfect for. So it was a perfect sort of opportunity for us to utilize it, to aid the sort of like the study. So. Yeah, a bit niche, and I don't think I'd be able to do it now. I don't think my eyes are as good, but certainly back then it's like such a tiny frog and such a tiny needle that it is something that you need to have practiced a lot. And obviously, no one wants to practice on a critically endangered species in the wild. So the technique was developed, and we practiced it a lot with a captive population initially of things like Polypodates. So gliding frogs from Southeast Asia. We did a lot of training using those because they're a bit bigger, but it works quite well with those. And a team of us developed the skills to do it. And then we go over to Madagascar and we train the guys over there. And the way you train people to use it is a little bit unusual. The way that I was taught how to do it was using a banana and a condom. So you put a condom on a banana. And you want to go through the condom, but not into the banana, is how we were trained to do it. So an unusual training method, especially going to Madagascar and teaching a dozen guys how to inject a condom over a banana. But, you know, it's worked out quite well.
That's one of the most incredible stories I've ever heard. There's so much to unpack here. So,
yeah.
And let's just forget the banana thing. But so, the dye or the ink, whatever you want to call it, this is only visible under a black light, or is it visible to the naked eye?
You can see it to the naked eye, but if you look, if we would put a red or an orange or a pink elastomer into a golden mantella leg, once it's in and it's set, you can sort of see it, but it's very hard to see. If you hold a black light over it, it just glows through the skin, really obviously. So it meant that it's not going to have a negative impact on the frog because it's on the underside, so predators aren't going to see it. And even then, it's not super visible with the naked eye. So it shouldn't have had any sort of like knock-on effect. And it's certainly, in terms of the actual process, you know, I guess I probably injected 600 or 700 frogs in Madagascar. But Eddie, who was the project leader from the NGO in Madagascar, he was there a lot more than we were. And I'd say he probably injected, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 mantellas. And in the whole of that time and that study, we never had any one of them go into shock or have any issues, and we've never never had any problems with it at all. So it seems like a fairly, once you've been trained properly, fairly safe procedure for the animal. To be honest, I quite often stab myself in the finger by accident with the syringe. So not necessarily safe for the user, but definitely fairly safe for the amphibian.
Yeah, I mean, I'm covered with tattoos, so I have an interest in that as well. How do you differentiate between the different individuals that have been tattooed? Is there a way, like, do you do it in batches? Is there some sort of way to differentiate which frogs were caught this year as opposed to 2 years ago? How do you interpret that?
Yeah, so we used four or five colors, and we used multiple locations on the animal. So, like, year one, week one would get injected in the, you know, right hind leg with orange, and then the next rotation you'd catch them. Any that had an injection, you wouldn't inject again. Obviously, anyone that had an elastomer marking, you would record the color and which leg it was and which sex it was, so that you got sort of data that way. And then any new ones you caught would get injected, same location, different color, until you've worked through all the colors, and then you switch location. And each of those sort of like periods was recorded, the population for each of the sites, the ponds that we were studying. It limited the study to sort of like 5 years, because then we were going to run out of legs and colors. But to be honest, 5 years of data from every breeding season, from the ponds that we were, the study was based at, was a lot of frogs.
Are these vernal pools that they're gravitating towards?
Not always. So that was part of the study as well. So two of the pools were sort of very sort of were like ephemeral ponds, and then the other two were sort of like slightly more permanent. So they were kind of like different habitats. The ones that were chosen were different habitats, based around pools. So like one was at the edge of a sort of open forest and a lot of grassland. One was like deep in a forest, in like where there's sort of almost like narrow streams rather than ponds, or narrow canals, that's probably better, running through the forest. One was a very large permanent pond that's a big pond that's always there. It sort of, you know, the water level rises and drops, but it never dries out. And then there was a site that's deep in the forest that like is dry as a bone, and then, you know, breeding season hits and it fills up with water after the first cyclone and doesn't dry out for long enough for the tadpoles to develop. So yeah, different sort of habitats. And to be honest, with the golden mantellas, you read a lot about them being found in pandanus forest, and there were a few pandanus trees about, but not many. I wouldn't say it was a forest of pandanus. It was sort of like a mostly sort of wooded rather than palmed sort of forest, and certainly not the sort of the habitat that a lot of the early sort of like documentation suggested that golden mantellas were found in. But yeah, nice, didn't you? Different between the four sites that we mainly studied.
What constitutes perfect habitat for golden mantella? Because mantella in the hobby here in the U.S. has not caught fire the way that the dart frog hobby has. And my suspicion is that has a lot to do with breeding behavior and tadpoles and whatnot. By and large, species like Tinctoris and Phyllobates are very easy to raise. What do we know about wild mantella breeding behavior versus captive mantella breeding behavior?
Yeah, so like not huge amounts, I guess. But as it goes, like Mantella aurantiaca is pretty well studied. Other mantellas a lot less so. But I guess mantella split into sort of like almost three categories. Really, there's a sort of a Mantella aurantiaca sort of breeding style, and there's a few other species that breed in the same way, like Mantella crocea and Madagascariensis and Polcra, and they're very straightforward. I would say that like golden mantellas and black-eared mantellas and things are probably the easiest species to breed, despite the fact they're CITES and critically endangered, Golden Mantellas are very easy to breed compared to the other group, which is sort of Mantella Baroni and Mantella Nigricans and Mantella Kawani, that are a lot harder to rear the tadpoles and a lot harder to organize them to actually spawn when and where you want them to. And certainly a lot trickier. And then there's the third group of the ones that are really weird, that think they're Ufaga. So Mantella levigata, and then another suggested species, both use sort of like broken bits of bamboo and tree hollows and water in pandanus leaves, almost as a dart frog would use a bromeliad. And they lay eggs and then they feed their tadpoles on feeder eggs. So very much like a sort of a pomelo-sized frog that acts very much like a pomelo would. They're not entirely Ufagus, so they will eat other things. So you can rear Mantella levigata using fish food, but in the wild, it would just be done on eggs, just like a pomelo. And they live a very different lifestyle altogether. But in terms of Arantiaca, there's been quite a lot of studies, and certainly whilst I was there, there was a researcher, a guy called Wayne Edwards, who was from the Durrell Institute of Conservation and Ecology down in Kent, and he was doing collecting data for his PhD, looking at habitat preference and usage of golden mantellas, and his studies suggest that the one of the key things is not any particular plant; it's the availability of leaf litter for them to live in, and that's almost quite sad, really. In the best thing for sort of like a mantella enclosure is probably not to have very many plants in it at all, and probably not to have too much apart from a few bits of twig and branch and a lot of leaf litter, which doesn't really sell them into the sort of the hobby as it would with a dart frog, if you know what I mean. It's a very sort of bland enclosure, and that would be where they would probably thrive. You can keep them in an enclosure like a dendrobatted frog, and you might be lucky and you might get them to breed, but they definitely do better in an enclosure with a lot of leaf litter and a little bit of water and not too much else, and obviously not as high temperatures. And the other key thing that makes them a bit tricky, not a bit tricky, but a bit less easy for people to breed, is that obviously you have to pay money for them, and they're not the cheapest frogs. They're not the most expensive either, but they're not super cheap frogs. And actually, your best plan is to see if you can get hold of something like 10 males for every 6 females. So your group sizes are not like dendrobatted frogs at all. You want to end up with, like, we've got groups Fantastic Frogs. We've got a group of golden mantellas. I think there's 28 golden mantellas in one enclosure, and green mantellas, we've got 23 in that enclosure, and they're sort of populations that now breed regularly. But I think when you haven't got enough frogs, it's quite, you're going to struggle to get them to breed. You've got to be very lucky to get sort of a mantella species breeding if you've just got a pair. Unlike dendrobatted frogs, which don't seem quite so fussy.
Is there a behavioral catalyst to the large groups that initiates breeding, or is it chemical? Like, what do you attribute having such a large group of animals together? What instigates breeding as opposed to just two of them?
Yeah, I think it's a competition. I think, the males tend to turn up at the pool slightly earlier than the females anyway. So for the first few days of the studies, you'd pick up a lot more males, and they'd be out in the open and they'd be making a lot of noise. And that's sort of like a competition thing. If you don't have it, if you've only got one or two males, the males call, but they don't really call very often. They don't call as much. So they don't advertise their readiness to mate. And they don't advertise their strength, which is linked to the calling. So if you haven't got enough males, they don't really trigger the females to move to the breeding site. So I think you need them. I've never tried it, but I imagine playing calls constantly would help if you've got a small population. But it's something that hasn't been tried and tested sort of scientifically.
That's interesting. It's a very different social dynamic than with the Dendrobatids. Because I think about the species that we do keep in groups, like Phyllobates, for example. Yeah. To my knowledge, it just seems to be they just tolerate each other. I don't know if anyone out there is listening, if they've had different breeding success based on group size. But, I mean, this is a parallel I've drawn with Pamelia, but the Mantellas almost sound more like birds with the kind of like a, you know, not a communal nesting site, but like I think of it's bird breeding, you know, flocks of birds, breeding behavior, whatnot, in a social environment as opposed to a solitary environment. It also reminds me of salamanders, United States, like the frosted flatwoods and some of the mole salamanders that will just kind of come to these vernal pools in mass and form these, you know, big breeding rituals. And that's fascinating behavior.
Yeah, we did work with Agalichnus moreleti, and some of the research guys went out to sort of Belize and the photographs of the breeding sites for those sort of frogs, moreleti and Caladrius red eyes, are these, you know, ponds surrounded by sort of overhanging leaves, and then you get trees with thousands of them on breeding, and it's a bit like that on a smaller oranger scale. But yeah, the breeding pools just all around the edges, you get Mantellas calling. And it is noisy and incredible to see.
How many species overlap in range?
Mantella-wise?
Yeah.
So within the forest that we worked in, although because I was always working with golden mantellas, I didn't see many of the others, but there was definitely Baroni and Crocia found it within that forest area, not sharing sites, but certainly out of breeding season, they would overlap, I would have thought, as they drift away from the ponds. As you move north towards the area that Devon was in, I think there's Crocia there, different coloured Crocia and Baroni. And as you move farther north, it sort of turns into Madagascariensis and Mylotympanum, but there's definitely a gap between them and the Orontiaca sort of like habitat. And as you go farther north again, you get to of the areas. They seem to spread themselves out. There's a couple. There's normally more than one species overlapping, but that's probably about it. Which I guess is similar with a lot of the dendrobates in Central America. There's only a couple really that are shared habitat, but yeah, definitely you get naturally occurring hybrids between, well, you can't really tell, but they're definitely weird looking, and they could be hybrids between Orontiaca and Baroni. It's more likely to be maybe Orontiaca and Crocia, because I think they're more closely related and they breed in a similar style. So but you definitely get wild occurring hybrids between them. And I think Devin at the moment is doing work with Mantella coani, farther south, and he's studying it at a site where there's what looks like hybrids between Mantella coani, which is literally one of the rarest amphibians in the world, and Mantella baroni, which is its closest relative. So there's animals that exhibit sort of patterns of both species. Excuse me. So yeah, there is some overlap and there is some hybridization, but mostly they kind of keeps themselves.
Yeah, the natural hybridization was kind of where I was going with that question, because again, in the hobby, and rightfully so, people don't want to create any hybridization that's unnecessary, because we kind of want to preserve what we've got as closely as to what we've got in the wild. But the more down the rabbit hole I've gone with talking to people is that natural hybridization seems to happen fairly commonly, and there's some strange genetic drift between dendrobatids, and there seems to be a lot more going on than just phenotype, and that intrigues me. Yeah. And I was curious if something like that happens with Mantella.
Yeah, it definitely does. I've got one in our collection. I'm not really sure what it's a hybrid of. It was imported probably 15 years ago or more. A wild caught import into the UK, labelled as Mantella madagascariensis. Some ended up at Paignton Zoo, which is down in the south coast of the UK. And they ended up with a group. And a few other people ended up with groups, but they were some sort of hybrid. And I've got one of those that's a remaining one that I kind of keep as an oddity. And I showed him to one of the guys out in Madagascar on the Mantella project, and he had photographs of animals found in the north of the where we were based, that's a hybrid that he believed was a hybrid between Arantiaca and Baroni. That looked almost identical to the frog that we got from that's like 15, 16 years old in our collection. So, yeah, quite sort of interesting, but it definitely occurs.
What do we know about genetic variability? In terms of any of the populations? I mean, obviously, golden mantella was the focus of much of your study. Is there anything that we know about distinct genetic populations or anything that would set them apart as unique?
We've certainly looked at that in Arantiaca, and there isn't there's not a huge amount of genetic variation across the whole of Arantiaca's distribution. Any of the sites, they're all very, very similar. There is some slight variation between the north and south, but not significant in reality. So, and that's the only species I've really got the information with. I think there's definitely some variation within Crocia across its range, because its phenotype is very variable, and it can look an awful lot like Myla tympanum, black-eared mantellas in some areas. Whether that is because it mimics it, and the bright orange frog is more toxic or not, I don't really know. But it is questions that I certainly ask myself, and it's certainly that's a population I'd love to get up to. If I ever get back to Madagascar, that's something I will definitely be going to look at, is black-eared mantella population and the associated Crocia populations, because that sort of intrigues me, interests me. But yeah, within Arantiaca, there's not a great deal of difference. And certainly, as I mentioned before, Luisa's research was looking at various questions relating to sort of ex situ conservation is a possible solution to golden mantella conservation, in that we know that they're bright orange for a reason. They're toxic, just like dart frogs. They get their toxicity sort of sequestered from their diet. They use their coloration as an advert of this. However, we know in captivity, if we don't get carotenoid supplementation right, then the frogs are not the same color as the ones in the wild. So if we are ever to want to try and put those animals back as a captive breeding for reintroduction, then you don't want to put yellow frogs back into an area where orange frogs are not taken by predators, because they're poisonous. But yellow frogs are just brightly colored and easier to spot. So then they get predated upon, and then they're not toxic because they've been bred in captivity and they haven't been sequestering the toxins. So they just get wiped out. It's almost like a pointless exercise. And now it's quite hard for us to make the frogs toxic, but if we can buy them enough time by making them look exactly like the wild caught animals in terms of color, hopefully the message will work. So part of her question was to see whether captive populations were fit enough for reintroduction. And she looked at various things, actual fitness, their coloration, and their calling, vocalization. Because obviously if you introduce frogs back into the area, to try and boost numbers, and you've got a population that you didn't know you had that's naturally occurring, are those naturally occurring frogs going to be able to interbreed with your reintroduced animals, or are they going to be wiped out by competition from your reintroduced animals? So you want to be able to find out, you know, try and predict what's going to happen. So she looked at vocalizations, she's looked at coloration. She's looked at their response to stress to see if they were fit to go back to the wild. And the coloration thing was interesting because we'd been told, and lots of people had said, that the population in the swamps up to the north were paler than the ones in the south by Moramanga, where we were working. So she went out and, using some incredibly high tech equipment, took skin samples, like, you know, photographs, right in very close to the animals' bodies with special technology to get hold of, like, an image that she could then run through as a piece of software to tell us exactly how it fitted on a scale, and compare it to wild ones, to captive ones at Chester Zoo, captive ones in Madagascar, wild ones in Madagascar, and see which one was the closest color and what we had to do to improve that in terms of carotenoid supplementation or whatever was needed to get it to be the right color orange. And what we found is that the two populations, there was no real differentiation between the north and south populations in terms of color, or in terms of stress response, or in terms of their calls. What we found is that without access to good carotenoid supplementation, you end up with frogs that are yellow or pale orange, and aren't as intense as the one from the wild. But if you give them good carotenoid supplementation, you can get them to that. So it is a problem that's fixable, but you have to, you know, you have to plan for it and have to, you know, look to do it at a very early age. They need kind of like supplementation whilst they're tadpoles to become froglets that are the right color. The other thing that we did was she was looking at the calls, and what she found was that she could, if she played a call from a frog that was at Chester Zoo in the wild in Madagascar, all the other frogs ignored it. They didn't respond at all. If she played a call from frogs that were at the Mitsinya facility that Devin used to manage, they're captive bred, but they're in Madagascar where they're growing up, they would, the wild frogs would respond to it. So we realized that the ones that were being bred at Chester had grown up with a funny accent, a bit like mine, whereas the ones bred over in Madagascar had a Madagascan accent, so everybody could understand each other. And what was also weird is if you played the Madagascan frogs call to the ones in Chester, they would respond to it positively. So they obviously knew what the call was, but somehow weren't making the same call themselves, which was obviously a sort of a captive issue rather than a captive Chester issue rather than a captive issue in general. So the next part of her studies, Louise's study, is looking at how to rectify that. So at the moment, I think Chester Zoo's got almost 700 golden mantellas that have been reared for us for this study, and they've got a sound booth, and the frogs being reared in the sound booth get played sound effects and the calls of the wild Madagascan forest, and the ones outside of it don't, and the ones inside of it seem to be developing calls that match the wild ones. So you can train your frog to speak Madagascan. So it's all like crazy sort of like useful captive research that has got an application for the wild conservation of the species. So it's some cool stuff, but genetically there's not much difference. But in terms of our captive population, there's a big difference.
That's I try to explain to people outside of this world how sophisticated these things actually are, and stuff like this. It never ceases to impress me that different locations of geographic locations can result in a different, I mean, accent, like you said, for better, lack of a better word. I mean, you and I both speak the same language, but we have dramatically different accents. It raises another question that kind of came up in my head as we were talking about this, the carotenoids. So throughout my interviewing people like yourself and had Matt Dugan on, I've had a couple of guests on throughout the course of the show, and we've talked about carotenoids because there seems to be a tremendous interest because of just what you said about coloration. And not just, like, let's just forget trying to get a captive specimen to have very vibrant color. Obviously, that's trumped by the need to have animals look and behave and exist the same way as their wild counterparts would if they're going to be candidates for reintroduction or for projects like that you've been involved in. So my question is, with regards to carotenoids, if we're supplementing these animals so heavily in captivity to get that desired result, what are they doing in nature that's resulting in that? And are we artificially doing this by creating, by supplementing with carotenoids, are we artificially recreating something that might be completely a different biological process in nature? That's what's been ticking around in my head lately.
Yeah, I think, like, my sort of involvement in carotenoid supplementation started when I started at Chester Zoo. And at the time, they were working with a student from Manchester Uni who was looking at the effects of carotenoids on Agalictus caladrius and Agalictus moreleti. And the moreleti population was held at Chester Zoo in a shipping container away from the public. No one knew that they were even there, really. And the research was taking place there. They were breeding animals, giving them carotenoid supplements to the adults and to the tadpoles, and seeing what came out. And some were giving it like at a high dose rate, some were giving it a low dose rate, some were giving none, and they would compare and see what was happening. And the reason they were doing it with those species is that they were using the carotenoid they were using was astaxanthin. And the reason was because astaxanthin had been isolated as being present in Agalictus caladrius and moreleti skin. So they knew that at some point in their diet, they were getting hold of that, which is odd because the easiest source of astaxanthin to get hold of is from like shrimp grown in Hawaii. So where they get it from in Belize, I'm not sure. But they were able to find an algae derived carotenoid that would naturally occur over there, but I've no idea how or where, but they were certainly able to sequester it. So that's where it sort of started. I think that research came before Dugas's stuff with the Pomelio. So I think it's referenced in their paper. The work that was done at Chester Zoo with the guys from Manchester Uni. And I think because it had been isolated and found with that group, and then it had been proven to work with Agalictus, that it was then the first go-to because it's already been proven to work with some amphibians. So it was then tried with the Pomelio and then subsequently with virtually any carotenoid study has tried it, I think, since. But where Mantella aurantiaca gets their coloration from and whether it's carotenoid based, I couldn't answer really. Although, without really scientifically testing this, so entirely kind of like just from my observations, one of the sites that we did our study at, the site that's sort of an open forest and grassland kind of habitat, the forest is the leaf litter is kind of like an orangey brown color, and in amongst it are tiny little bright orange seeds, fruits, berries, that's the word, little berries. And I imagine if those contain sort of a beta carotene, which is found in plant matter, then it could easily be something that insects are eating that would get into their food chain. But again, that's a hypothesis that's not been tested yet.
That's interesting. And that's been sort of the million-dollar question is how, like, for example, carotenoids, why don't I turn orange from eating, well, I kind of am, I've got red hair, but that was a bad example. But like, if I were to take a heavy dose of carotenoids, why don't I turn orange? Why does it affect frog pigment this way? That's such an interesting question. But that's interesting though, about the fruits in the leaf litter. Yeah, the leaf litter was another thing I meant to back up and ask you about when we were talking about habitat and how to set them up appropriately in a vivarium. So leaf litter wise, are we talking dry leaf litter with ambient humidity? Are we talking wet leaf litter? Are we talking dry and dry? What sort of ambient conditions do those, does the leaf litter and the air be kept in?
Yeah, it changes over the course of the day. And certainly you get heavy rainfall, so everything ends up wet. And certainly during the breeding season, it's all damp leaf litter and very damp researchers. But at the same time, like, there are areas of open forest where we would encounter Mantellas. As we walked towards the sites we were going to do testing, there's paths cuts into the forest that the villagers use and that we use to get deeper into the forest. And open areas, and you'd find them sat out in, you know, out in early morning, but very bright, high lux sunlight at quite high temperatures, much higher than we'd recommend keeping Mantellas in captivity at, along the edge of these paths. And the leaf litter and the ground there was dry and dusty, and you'd get frogs hopping about it. Yeah, so in areas within the sort of habitat, the leaf litter is incredibly dry at the surface. But obviously, they can get down in amongst tree roots and deep underneath the leaf litter where the humidity is fairly constant. And then also, there are very distinct seasons in Madagascar. So you do get a huge cyclone season that starts around sort of early, you know, start of the year, around January. Certainly, I arrived in January once, the day after a cyclone had half destroyed the area that we were going to be staying in. So you get these huge cyclones on the east coast coming in from the sea, and huge storms bring vast amounts of water in, and everything gets flooded, and the river's levels rise, and these ponds that they breed in form, and it stay like that for 3 or 4 months, and then it dries off really heavily down towards sort of like end of sort of like November, or you know, beginning of November, it'll be incredibly dry. But they obviously find places to sort of get out of the water.
So here's another question that when I worked up an outline, I was thinking about how I wanted to kind of introduce this topic. And I think we've sort of set it up, and that is captivity versus wild. And I feel like there's been a strong push, not just in the amphibian hobby as well, but in other herp-related hobbies, to try and replicate an animal's natural surrounding as closely as possible in a captive setting. But what you're just talking about, seasonal variability and layers of leaf litter and gradients, and sometimes there'll be a storm and sometimes there won't be, we're not necessarily going to be able to do that. So it almost seems like what we're doing is we're just taking the average and we're rolling with that. And not to anthropomorphize, but when you think about human beings, most human beings, it's fair to say, are going to be comfortable around 72 degrees. That seems to be the default. I mean, yeah, we can be outside on a 100-degree day. We can be outside when it's 40. We just dress slightly differently. But at the end of the day, if you were going to keep a human being in a terrarium, 72 degrees would probably be the most appropriate. What are your thoughts on trying to replicate nature? And like in a zoo environment, which is, zoos and hobbyists are going to kind of face the same challenges. I mean, you're in the UK, I'm here in the northeastern US. Obviously, we can't recreate Madagascar or Panama or Peru. What are your thoughts on that, about maintaining captive animals in a environment that attempts to replicate their natural environments? Like, what are some limitations, and are there any ideas in terms of how we could more closely replicate that? Is it something that we're limited? Like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like we mentioned it. We mentioned it. Sorry. Lily, shush. Not that she understands me. Yeah, we mentioned it before in the last one. You mentioned how my travels had affected, had it had any effect on how I kept things. And my travels definitely had. For a while, I only kept things that I'd seen in the wild, which is a bit snobby. to just be keeping things that I'd only seen in my wondrous travels. But certainly it's things that I felt that I understood better because I'd seen them in the wild and I had an understanding of how their habitat worked. And that's, for a while, I was like, right, I'm only going to keep stuff that I saw in, you know, Pomelio, that I saw in Panama, that I visited their habitat, that I got an idea of what it looked like, what plants were there, what branches were there. And that's what I've ended up doing. I've got these vivs, I've got these frogs in them. And then because of the stuff with the mantellas, that we were collecting all this environmental data at the same time as the frog data, what I really realized is that my 2 weeks spent in Panama has showed me virtually nothing about what the environment in Panama really is like, because I've just had this snapshot of 2 weeks. And actually, when I went in 2016, they'd not had rain for weeks, and it was very unusual. So actually, when I went, was an exceptionally dry, wet season. So I got even more skewed sort of information about how we keep them, or how I felt I'd keep them. All that information that I thought was great was actually very skewed because of the environmental ecological situation that was happening in Panama at the time. So I kind of realized that it's very hard. It's an incredible ideology that we want to create things that are recreate these wild habitats and match them. And technology is amazing. You know, I can pull up on my phone what rain levels were falling in Central America yesterday without too much hard work. You can go and have a look at the last 5 years of rainfall in Costa Rica around Monteverde, if that's what you wanted to do. But it's still going to be incredibly hard to get it exactly right. And we don't know what damage we'll be doing by getting it slightly wrong. So I kind of feel that actually that keeping people at 72 approach, where we know that they are happy and surviving without any negative sort of impacts, might be the best thing we can do, because actually trying to do more, we don't know what damage we might be doing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it does. I was thinking about homeostasis and how every living thing needs to maintain homeostasis. And for human beings, we can't handle too much heat. We can't handle too much cold. Yes, it's nice to go outside on a sunny day, but you're not going to sit out in the sun and bake in dry heat at 120 degrees. And at the same time, you're not going to go out when it's 30 degrees with no jacket on and stay out there. You're going to try and, yes, it's stimulation. It's whatever, some kind of climate enrichment, if that's the term people want to use. But at the same time, it's almost like, are you providing the animals the perfect way to maintain homeostasis in captivity, as opposed to providing extremes like you just mentioned? Like I understand exactly what you mean. I agree. I feel like it's that law of averages where you want to give them opportunities to thermoregulate and whatnot and maintain homeostasis, but at the same time, you don't want to give them these very dramatic extremes like an extreme dry season or other things that might put pressures on them that would result in a natural environment might result in fatalities and things like that. So yes, I get it, and I agree with you.
We saw temperatures in Madagascar where the golden mantellas were daytime temperatures were like 40, 42 degrees centigrade. So what's that? That's, you know, is
it's
that
100 hot.
Degrees more? It's a lot. It's hot.
It's really hot.
And they're hiding, and it's really hot. And if we were to follow that and try and provide that spike in heat that they find in the wild at surface ground level, you know, their ability to get a foot, 18 inches, 2 foot beneath the surface of the leaf litter in amongst the roots of trees is going to be incredibly hard for us to recreate in a vivarium, or it'd have to be a very big vivarium, to give them that opportunity to get away from that heat and to give them those options. So it's not entirely feasible to safely recreate those extremes. So yeah, it's just a you just have to be incredibly careful with how you attempt to mimic the environment.
Yeah, I feel like we have our ideas of what nature is like, and a lot of times we're biased, like you mentioned with a snapshot going to Panama for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, where I live, I know what the climate's going to be year round. I mean, right now where I am, it's March. It's basically 40 degrees and rainy from like February until like the 1st of May. So I kind of know what I'm going to expect, but I can't predict what's going to happen outside of my little microcosm. I don't know every single weather pattern, and I don't know every single weather pattern is going to behave, how it's going to influence the animal's behavior. But, I mean, again, this is more of just kind of like a philosophical discussion, but I see the way that we create, we recreate habitats based on what we think it will look like. And for example, the bromeliads, I love bromeliads. I love Neo-Rigelia. I love bromeliads. I think they're beautiful. They complement vivariums wonderfully, but they're not growing a foot off the ground, and they're not growing many different species or varieties all at once. I mean, you might have like 8 or 10 of the same bromeliad 100 feet up in the air. And yet we somehow in our heads, we justify, all right, this is natural. This is the way it's supposed to look like. In reality, it's, you know, if it was a 100-foot tall vivarium, it would make sense. But for an 18-inch tall or 30-inch tall, it's just, it seems like something that we've contrived.
The thing I noticed in Panama is that in the garden of the place we were staying on Colon, there were lots of xanthosoma, so an aroid. And the xanthosomas have got like urns, like a bromeliad urn. And it was xanthosoma that we found Colon pomelo in, all over the place. So growing out the ground, a plant that's probably 4 to 5 foot tall growing, one plant would have like a, you know, half a dozen urns in it, and there'd be frogs all over the place within it, especially when it was the middle of the day when it was hot. They'd all retreat into these little water reservoirs at ground level underneath the shade of these big leaves. And it was entirely not, like, there's no way we could replicate that in a vivarium of any normal size. It would have to be huge to grow one of those plants in. Whereas the habitat had like dozens and dozens of it, growing all over the place, and there were frogs all over it. And they seemed to use that certainly more than any of the bromeliads that were growing up the trees in the gardens. We didn't find hardly any in bromeliads, certainly of Isla Colon race of pomelo anyway. So yeah, it's we do give a, we've got a view, and certainly there's like this image that you get, and I've got one up here in 19, what is it? Let's have a quick look. March 1975, National Geographic has got an article about bromeliads in it, and it's got an artist impression of a bromeliad filled with frogs and Boletta glossa salamanders and all sorts. And those are the images that you get given. You find yourself a book on the Central American rainforests, and you find a bit about poison arrow frogs, and there's a picture of a bromeliad with a frog sat in it. So you kind of get that image is reinforced. And obviously we keep bromeliads in viv. So if you pick up a book about dart frogs, there'll be a painted picture of a viv filled with bromeliads as well. And whether they actually all really need them, whether it's very realistic, like you say, you know, a lot of those species, especially things like Ranitomea, and Ufago arborea, they're going to be up high and your viv's never going to be able to have the same sort of air movement that a bromeliad 50 meters up a tree has got compared to a glass box 2 foot off the ground. So it's tough.
It would be amazing though. Imagine you.
Yeah, it would.
I have a 2-story house, and now I'm thinking about just going down to the basement and just cutting a perfectly square opening through the first floor up into the second floor and just building this. And I know one of you out there is going to do it. I know somebody listening is going to do that.
Yeah,
you're going to do a tower of vivarium. It's only a matter of time. but it's those behaviors that are interesting. And I just feel like they're going to behave naturally in captivity to the best of their abilities. But at the same time, yeah. we've created an environment that's our ideal for them.
Yeah. And yeah, it's, you know, a lot of it's done with the absolute best intentions.
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
I mean, everybody does their best, but it is probably almost impossible to replicate a wild environment. And we're never going to be able to achieve it in a captive environment. So you kind of have to some extent, pick your battles. And, you know, with Mantellas, it's, you know, for me, keeping Mantellas is quite boring in that it's quite a large tank. There's quite a lot of frogs. It's got a small patch of water in it and a lot of small brown leaves and not much else. And they do well in it, but it's and that's great because that's what it looked like where I was, but it's not going to make them popular because it doesn't look like it's in a rainforest. It's not a hugely aesthetically pleasing. Whether I desperately want Mantellas to be a popular pet species, I don't know. But whereas dart frog keeping for me is I put a load of bromeliads on a branch in a vivarium. So like one, I'm like going exactly like I saw it in the wild, and the other one, I'm going like, oh, I'm not worried about that. I just want it to look pretty in my room. So it is odd how people sort of approach these things.
Yeah, and you raised a good point. Again, it's a lot of it also to do with public perception of, because I mean you've been there, you know what these environments look like. You've been, yeah, to these places, you've spent time there. I've never been there. I don't know exactly what it looks like. So I just go on what other people say or photographs and whatnot. And you're right that, especially when you're doing an exhibition in any type of environment where you're showing, yeah, the frogs off to the public's going to want to see what they think this area, yeah, looks like. But to be honest, I think the idea of having Mantella the way they would be in the wild on dry leaf litter, I think that's actually pretty cool. To me, that's actually more interesting than the stereotypical kind of planted tank that we all seem to gravitate towards.
You can see it in zoos. Like the number of zoos globally that have got a large rainforest biome that you can go and see is definitely increasing. And you can go and see rainforest biomes that are based on Southeast Asia, that are based on Central America, that are maybe just rainforest as a habitat. But the number of them that have got sort of like lost temples or vast, like huge buttress roots, almost every single one's going to have that. But not every single actual rainforest looks like that. But they're playing to an audience. You know, you're recreating something that people are going to be satisfied and they'll go and look at and they'll think, yeah, this looks like a rainforest. This is where you'd see Hanuman langurs or whatever. And they go away happy that those animals are being taken care of to the best of their abilities, even though perhaps that habitat doesn't reflect the actual wild habitat of the species. It is, like you say, just the perceived habitat of a species. And zoos do it all the time. And we do it all the time as hobbyists as well. But
oh, yeah. I'm definitely guilty of that. I do that. I'm, yeah, terrible with that stuff. But it's fun, though. Again, it's captive. It's realistically the hobby is for people. It's a pursuit for us to, yeah, create something that we enjoy, that we find visually appealing. And I'm not trying to detract from that at all. I've just become more interested in the wild versus captive dichotomy and how,
yeah,
wild frogs are so different than captive frogs, and all those variables that we create, all those variables that we eliminate when we have our vivarium in our home. I'm just curious about how those wild variables manage to, what makes a wild frog versus what makes a captive frog. And these are all those little intricacies and whatnot that interest me as of late.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see if you go and look at them and you see what they're living in the wild and how they're utilizing that habitat and how well they utilize the habitat that we create that doesn't represent that. It's amazing how adaptable they are. Because, you know, we often keep things, like you say, we often keep things that are drastically different from how they would live in the wild, but they still seem to adapt and I'm going to say thrive, but certainly survive in those sort of like habitat. But it's interesting to say, like, about, I guess, in the early 2000s, I was preparing to go to a large reptile show. It's a show called Ham. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's like Europe's biggest herp show. It's absolutely massive. Sees about 20,000 people a day go through it three times a year. And it's absolutely vast. And that's where we used to travel to buy our dart frogs. And so, you know, 3 days travel to bring back half a dozen dart frogs. And we'd spend a lot of money. And dart frogs cost a lot of money. Certainly some of them do. And the guy I was traveling over there with had been a fish keeper. He'd always kept tropical fish. And he'd used to breed Corydoras catfish. And he'd breed thousands of them. He'd sell them to pet shops and to hobbyists and all sorts of stuff. And one year he decided he would see how much money he could generate from his hobby. And he paid it all into a savings account. And then he used that money to travel to the Amazon and spent 4 weeks on a boat going up the Amazon, looking at fish collections and fish habitats and all sorts of stuff. And he said to me, he said, like the amount of money I was taking to spend in Ham, I could have flown from the UK to Costa Rica and Panama, like maybe half a dozen times the amount of money that I was spending in a year buying frogs. And he couldn't believe that I'd never gone and seen them, but I was spending that much money on them in captivity. And I thought to myself, no, he's right. Perhaps I should save up and actually go and see what they look like in the wild. And I think it started something that was probably not good for me, because I've become a little bit obsessed with going to these places, but was one of the best things that ever sort of was triggered in my brain, was that I could go and see these things in the wild, and how great it was to just see them and not to keep them, but to see them in the wild. Obviously, I was never going to stop keeping them because I'm a frog obsessive, but it was definitely a great thing. I'd recommend it to anybody who's listening if the opportunity arises. And it's relatively easy for you guys to get to Bocas del Toro nowadays. I think they have quite a spring break community down there going on of people that have moved down there. So it's definitely worth a trip.
Yeah. I always enjoy hearing people who've gone in situ and seen things in the wild, 'cause it just paints such a different perspective. 'Cause I feel like we live in such in a bubble in the hobby. Yeah. There's just so much more going on outside that, you know. Ben, I want to ask you, if, let's just say if money was no object and you had 6 months, is there a certain place that you would want to go to observe a wild frog of any species? Like if I said, all right, here's $1 million and here's 6 months, go observe this species, which would it be?
Oh man, that's tough. I think because of my background, I've got multiple sort of like drivers for it. So part of my brain would be saying that, like, you know, I know there's a species and I know there are people working with it, so perhaps I don't need to go. But Mantella coani in the central highlands of Madagascar, it's under so much threat, it's ridiculous. And I could spend 6 months collecting data out there and watching them that might be really valuable. But at the same time, I would love to get into sort of like, as a species that I would like to see in the wild, and I don't think I ever will, it would be probably the Brazil nut frog, Adelphobates castanioticus, because it's found in Brazil. It lives this weird life where it lays its eggs in fallen Brazil nuts. It's a stunning frog. It's got so little, there's so few images of its wild habitat. There's like nothing. I would love to spend 6 months in the Brazilian Atlantic rainforests and rainforests looking at dart frogs. That'd be incredible. I think that's what I'd go with.
It's a good choice.
What about you? What would you go with?
Oh, that's a good one. You know, I mean, to be honest, I haven't been to any of the places that you've been, so I'm sure my answer would probably be very sophomoric, but I would probably say I would maybe start with Costa Rica and then maybe work my way out from there. I don't know. It's hard. I mean, Madagascar is also really appealing too. This may sound really strange, but I mean, earlier we were talking about islands, and I'd almost prefer to just go to some island with the Majorcan midwife. Like, that would be great to go to Majorca, or and we were talking about New Zealand earlier. I'd love to go to New Zealand and see species there. I mean, not necessarily any one species. I think that the location would be more interesting to me. Some place that would be just alien to me, if you will, because I live in my own little box here. I've been all over the US, and I went to the UK about 20 some odd years ago, but that's my limits. I'd like to see another biome is really what I'd like to see. That interests me the most, I'd have to say.
Yeah, I think that's I love Costa Rica. I went to Costa Rica once. I've been to Panama a couple of times. I love that Central American rainforest. I've not experienced proper South American rainforest, and I kind of hope to, but I liked Central America so much, I'm kind of desperate to go back. And I'd love to go back to Madagascar not working, because when I was sent there with the zoo, there's a very conscious sort of back of your mind that I'm basically working. I'm being paid to be there. It's a fantastic place to be. And it's something I definitely don't want to not be grateful that I got to go. But I do desperately wanted to spend as much of the time there doing something useful. However, that meant I only really saw the two areas that we were doing research in. And the whole rest of the country was I kind of missed. And there's stuff there that I'd love to see in the wild that I didn't, even though I'd been there. So I'd like to go back as a tourist. With no design or no plan to do work, and just get to go to visit the nice places and see the pretty frogs. And I'd love to do that, but I don't know whether I could. I don't know whether I'd feel bad going there and then not catching up with the people from the NGO that I worked with and not going out and helping them. So it's like if I went to Madagascar, I'd feel indebted to go and try and do work with people, so I wouldn't get to see the bits that I wasn't able to last time. So it's a bit odd. I do want to go back, but I'll probably end up going back to Central America, where I didn't have the pressure of work and just got to play chasing frogs for a bit and do that, because it was so nice. But then I worked with mountain chickens in Montserrat in the Caribbean. And Montserrat as an island was absolutely destroyed. And when I went back, they were just really starting to rebuild after the effects of various things, but mostly a volcano that had erupted years beforehand. And they were struggling to get past that. So there was a lot of sort of temporary buildings that were housing people rather than actual sort of buildings and facilities. And that's all sort of changed. And I'd really like to go back and see that. But there's no point in going back looking for mountain chickens, because I don't think there's going to be any there, really. So I'd be going back really as an excuse to go for a holiday in the Caribbean.
You know, a little bit more thought. I want to amend my answer to the last question. I'd like to see a Goliath frog. I feel like I could.
Would be cool.
That would probably be the high point of my life, seeing a wild Goliath frog.
Yeah, that would be cool. And hairy frogs. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, or even
West Africa.
Even a wild pixie frog, like a big male.
Yeah,
That would be
doing his thing.
Yeah, that would be like my version of Safari. I guess people would want to go to that area and see elephants or rhinos. I'd be more interested in seeing a frog.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, Ben, we're kind of winding down, but I wanted to have a discussion with you about captive bred animals versus wild caught. And obviously, you know, again, kind of the focus of a lot of the discussions, a lot of conversation I've had with people has been the wild counterparts of what we have in captivity and how the hobbyist dynamic is evolving towards reliance on captive bred animals, whether they come from outside of the country and are imported, or they're inside the country and imported. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, does wild caught have a value in terms of maintaining the stock that we have in captivity? And are there ways that we can preserve wild caught stock without exploiting it, and at the same time be able to maintain captive populations?
Yeah, it's interesting, and that's a tricky thing as well. Our kind of grasp on captive populations can be a bit skewed as well. I did a very short course, a very brief introduction to population management, so that I could hopefully manage a stud book within a zoo collection. And it was quite interesting. It opened my eyes to quite a few things. But the thing that sort of probably stuck with me the most, well, after the fact that it's an absolute nightmare trying to keep track of the genetics of all these animals, and you are entirely reliant on a piece of software. After that, it was that certainly with amphibians, if you've got a small population, and what they deem a small population to manage is a population of, for conservation, this is of 100 pairs of unrelated wild caught frogs would make up your founder population. And we've probably never really had that. There's probably been times when those animals have been imported, but I don't think when those sort of quantities were coming into the hobby, very few of those animals would have survived. Then the numbers that were coming in subsequently have been a lot smaller and have been fairly non-managed, but that's what they would call a small population. Anything smaller than that is very hard to manage. And what they said about it is, if you've got less than 100 pairs, one of the things you end up doing is you're going to start with, say, you've got 100 individuals, so 50 pairs of animals that are unrelated, and you breed those. And then what do you do with those offspring? Do you then crossbreed them to other offspring from other members of those 50 pairs? And that's what you'd think of. But as soon as you've done that, you're down to 25 lines, because you've halved everything by pairing it all up. And then the next generation you breed narrows the gene pool even further. So what they suggest is that you would breed sort of probably brother, sister for sort of like 10 or 15 generations before breeding out. Because that buys you the most amount of time in terms of generational breeding to try and solve the problem that's happening with your animals in the wild. So it'll give you decades to try and solve whatever the threat is in the wild that means you have to have a captive breeding program, as it were. So it doesn't seem right, but you want to purposely inbreed if you've got a small population, so that you preserve the ability to outbreed for as long as you possibly can. And that's the situation we're in now, to some extent, because we don't know if or when there'll ever be regular wild caught importation of Dendrobates tinctorius, of blue Dendrobates auratus. Like, you know, we don't know that there'll be regular wild caught animals coming in to support the captive population. So what we have to think about really is managing our existing captive population for as long as we can, which is what we're trying to do with Fantastic Frogs, by being able to be as sustainable for as long as we possibly can for the hobby. And it's different because it's a hobby than it would be for conservation. And actually, the results of inbreeding in amphibians is very minor. Generally, you take a lot of generations before you start seeing any actual visible effects of inbreeding, generally. So unless you're breeding something with an obvious trait. So you can manage for quite a long time. So in terms of what we need, in terms of wild caught animals coming into the hobby, we might need some in the future. But actually, if you're taking a Dendrobates tinctorius that can live and breed for probably 15 years, that's just one generation for that 15 years. Then towards the end of its life, you hold back juveniles to be your second generation. And that one can go for like 10 years of breeding before you have to maintain and hold back a new bloodline or a new pair. So you can go 50, 60, 70 years and only be 4 or 5 generations from your original founders. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It's an interesting strategy, though.
Wild caught animals? We've probably got enough to maintain the species if we plan it and we work as a community to maintain this, the diversity of species. We can probably maintain the hobby for 50 years without needing any more wild caught frogs. Are we that organized? Probably not. So whether the hobby needs wild caught frogs coming in might differ from whether we require it because we've not been very good at managing our populations. And that's certainly like there's localities of tinctorius that are virtually impossible to find in the UK or even in Europe now. So we've obviously mismanaged some of those because they were definitely here 10 years ago and they're definitely not available anymore. So we're not doing a great example of maintaining a population. Whether wild caught animals per se are a bad thing, I think the situations are very, very dependent on the species. Like there's still a quota for golden mantellas. And actually there's quite a strong sort of like support for that quota to not be decreased, but to be increased to some extent. And that actually it's quite a good thing because it's placing value on a habitat for the locals that would actually not, like in a lot of the areas, would be chopped down and turned into rice paddy fields or would be burnt to make charcoal. But if they're able to make an amount of money preserving that habitat because at certain seasons of the year there's an opportunity to sustainably harvest from it, you know, it keeps the forest as a forest and not as a charcoal factory. So that works well with that species. I don't know how well it works with other species, certainly other Mantella species. I don't see it working as well with, and certainly other amphibians globally, it might not work well with, but there is certain circumstances where I do believe that wild caught trade is benefiting the wild population as well as the captive hobby population. Yeah, that's what I think.
That's a very interesting way of thinking about it. I never would have even thought that way, but it makes sense. I mean, the parallel that I can draw is here in the Northeast U.S., we've got a very, as of now, we've got a very, very much improved and very much healthy game fish stock. There's a few species in the Northeast that are very closely regulated by state and then federal authorities. And we lost a tremendous amount of biomass in the 80s due to purse seining, where it had a lot to do with shifts from other countries are coming in. They basically purse seining massive amounts of menhaden, which is a forage fish for many different species here on the East Coast. And they form in schools of millions. And the unintended consequences of this were as follows. So game fishing in the Northeast is huge. It's a big lobbyist organization. I fish. I'm very actively involved in that community as well. And there was a lot of pushback against the purse seining from fishermen who wanted to make use of the striped bass fishery. And they were able to lobby enough successfully that they were able to get this purse seining operation done for. They cannot do it within state waters. And as a result, the Menhaden population it blew up. So that recovered. The striped, but the striped bass population recovered as well. And in addition to that, we have more whales. We have more seals. I mean, I see whales and seals every single time I go out. We've got a healthier biomass in general living here because of the need to harvest the single species. That's how much that did. So by protecting the need for a species to harvest, it managed to cultivate this very rich environment that so many other species that were absent for years were able to thrive in. But I never thought of that as, you know, as it would relate to frogs. But yeah, you're right. You raise a good point that a quota system for wild-caught Mantella, if that helps preserve acres and acres of, or as close to pristine as you can get environment, that's something we'd have to consider.
Yeah, yeah. And like, you know, the thing about it is that golden mantellas live in that forest, but that's not the only thing that lives in that forest. Like, you know, we would regularly see Brachycia, superciliaris, like little pygmy leaf chameleons. We regularly see Europlatus, like leaf-tailed geckos, chameleons, Falsuma. In fact, the forest where Mantella aurantiaca is, you go 200 meters vertically above sea level, you end up in this area where you've got these at the top of the forest where you get these huge trees that have grown out of the canopy and have grown up and died, and they're old. No idea how old they are. And those dead trees sticking out of the forest is the only habitat in the world of Falsuma pronki. And Falsuma pronki is a small day gecko, looks like a really rubbish Falsuma clemeri, yellow-headed gecko, looks like a really rubbish one of those. And they hide underneath the bark that's peeling off the dead tree. And they hunt insects that are into the sun and into the warmth of the exposed dead trees. And that's the only place they live. They lay their eggs underneath that bark. And it's the only place in the world that it is. If those mantellas weren't there and that protected area hadn't been created, the legislation in Madagascar allows people to take dead trees from the forest to use as charcoal. They're not allowed to chop down healthy trees. But when the dead trees are the only habitat of a critically endangered species, then, like, you know, that would have been Falsuma pronki gone, pretty much. But because the mantellas are protected there, there's a lot of protection. The habitat's being protected. No one's taken anything from the forest. Or if they try, tend to get chased off by villagers who are very proud to support the project. So it saved a number of species that would have been threatened or even extinct just because the Mantella project happened and because the area became a recognized protected area. So, you know, it's done great things, and it's supported by the villagers being involved in the project and being able to support their families from the support that's given by the NGO and by the overseas partners. So it's a great little project. And so many other things have benefited from being in the area where the golden mantellas are.
That's encouraging to hear. I like to hear success stories like that.
It's amazing. Whilst we were there, they've discovered several species of chameleon in the forests that are new to science. Like, I think the one that's probably most famous is Culluma tarzan, which was described a few years ago, but there's several others that they haven't described, just because as soon as they described Culluma tarzan, someone went out there trying to collect them because they had the paper describing where their habitat was. So they've kind of held back on describing some species from around that area, just because they don't want to sort of encourage collections. But there's some incredible stuff there, you know, incredible species. And lemurs. 3 years I'd been going out there, and I hadn't seen a lemur in Madagascar, because I was always on the ground and they were always up in the tops of the trees. So I'd hear them go overhead, but not see them. But I eventually managed to see Indri and Shifaka in the forest and stuff. So it's a great sort of great habitat that's being supported by the presence of the golden mantellas.
I'd love to see an eye with that.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. They have.
They find evidence of eye in that protected area, but I never got to see them. But yeah.
That's a crazy looking animal.
Yeah. Yeah. Weird. Very weird.
So Ben, when are we going to do part three? I feel like we've covered so much, and again, we could go so much further. You're just such a dude. You're like a cauldron of knowledge when it comes to frogs. Like I, the amount of stuff that you know is just incredible.
It's because I'm old. I think when I was at Bristol Zoo and I decided that I was going to focus on amphibians, there was no one else who was interested in amphibians, like anywhere, as far as I can remember, certainly within the zoo industry. It was like a total void. So I cultivated it, but now everybody does it. I'm not special anymore. But yeah, it's been the dominating part of my career. I've been frogs. It's very odd. My parents wouldn't have been surprised, but I definitely was.
Yeah, I don't think that younger people really realize that the paucity of information that was out there in the 70s and then in the 80s and the 90s, and just how everything just seems to have grown exponentially within the past maybe 15 years. I never thought I would see, I mean, frogs that were just a little blurb in a magazine or in a book now have scientists like yourself making full careers out of them. I mean, it took a long way to get here, and obviously people like you deserve a lot of credit because you did a lot of trailblazing and did a lot of groundwork for people to follow. And I think that you did a fantastic job expanding the knowledge base. But I feel like younger people don't realize that this information wasn't there in the 70s and 80s and 90s. It was just, you had the hobby, you had price lists, whatever came in. And it took a long time for this knowledge base to get established.
Yeah, sadly, an awful lot of failures. You know, in the late 90s, I saw a pet shop not far from where I lived advertising Atelopus peruensis, the Peruvian high altitude Atelopus. And I went to the pet shop and they had three left, which I bought, which was probably a mistake as well. But he'd had a batch of 50 come in. I don't know if I'm not 100% certain, but I think the species is possibly extinct. They used to turn up in the pet trade in the UK. It was, you know, insane, really, the stuff that came in back then and the things that we learned that we didn't know, if you know what I mean. I remember finding a lot of things that I realised that was false information that was available back in the sort of late 80s and early 90s about keeping reptiles and amphibians that, you know, is really rubbish, which never helped anybody. But, you know, maybe in 10 years' time they'll be saying the same things about some of the stuff I've told you, so.
Oh, I mean, that's... Science is not a static thing. And things can be disproven and things can be... You know, certain things are common. I mean, we know that certain things happen consistently. But who knows what the future is going to hold? Maybe my obsession with creating wild frogs in captivity, you know, Superman frogs, maybe that'll come through for me. It could, who knows? 10 years from now, people could be saying, you know, all these years, we thought carotenoids were what we needed, and all we needed was, I don't know, X or Y, whatever. You know, it would be so, it'll be interesting to see how the landscape changes in the next 10 years.
Yeah, it's good to know that there's a community of frog keepers that are actually looking at these sort of things. You know, the number of people that contact us looking for carotenoid supplements and asking for that information is encouraging, because there's people that are actually looking at things in a lot more depth than when I started this hobby. You know, there was no interest in those sort of things. There was very little interest in the variety, in keeping a wider variety of live foods for dart frogs to be fed. But now, like, you've got people who are obsessed with all the different types of live food that you can cultivate and breed for your frogs. You know people with 5 or 6 different types of Drosophila. I'm not sure nutritionally if there's that much difference between any of them, but like, that certainly wasn't like an option when I first started keeping dart frogs, and that's all good.
Yeah, I'd like to see some better feeder options than.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be another thing in 10 years. Like, oh, you guys only fed fruit flies. You not didn't use,
yeah,
I don't know,
yeah,
Martian weevils or some, I don't know. I just made that terrible name up, but there could be
some. I've started hearing from, like, speaking to sort of like mainland Europe breeders, and a lot of people are sort of saying, you know, that they're cultivating mites to feed to their frogs when they're very little. There are mites that are smaller than springtails. And are often the things that we're like, oh my God, we've got mites in our springtail culture, we'll get rid of them. But like, yeah, people are actually cultivating mites to use as a food option. And you get a lot of leaf mites in the forest. Probably quite a good source of food for small frogs. I don't desperately want to start cultivating mites in my house. But, maybe somewhere in the future there'll be a type of cultured mite that offers a food option for dart frogs. Certainly seems to be in Europe at the moment.
Plus, how do we quantify?
Plus,
how do we quantify what constitutes something that's nutritionally complete? Like,
yeah.
There have been things done with crickets and mealworms and superworms and whatnot. I think that's a lot of the companies that breed the feeders or sell the feeders have independent people come in and do that. But there's a couple of papers floating around out there. But it'd be interesting to see some sort of objective study to determine what the nutritional content is of these feeders versus what the need is in dart frogs.
Yeah, that's a lot of the problem. When I was at the zoo, we had a. She's a professional animal nutritionist, and actually I think she works in San Diego now. She used to work at Chester, but she's over in San Diego. If you can track her down, she's called Dr. Andrea Fidget. She's done a lot of work with tree frogs and dart frogs, and then also with, like, you know, chimpanzees and a huge range of animals, but she knows her stuff, sort of thing. And they did a cycle looking at a lot of the feeders that we used in the zoo, and you get a lot of information. We know a lot about what is in a black-field cricket compared to an American banded cricket, but we still don't really know what what the animals that eat those actually require. So that's the sort of like a missing link of this information. We can kind of get a guess of how much protein and how much fiber and stuff, but we don't know exactly. We know exactly what's in a dead cricket because we can crush them up and get them tested. But doing the same and trying to find out, there's very few very accurate documentation of wild diets of dart frogs that are able to give us the same sort of information, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But it's hard to know what they really need. Again, there's just so many variables. Yeah.
I know. It's
maybe next time.
It's like any type of discussion like this is like you're hitting a pinata, and once you hit on an idea, all these other little ideas come out. But yeah, that's what's fun about having these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, Ben, we're going to wrap it up, but I want to thank you again for taking the time to come on. And our first conversation blew me away. We covered so much ground. It was so fascinating, and I'm really grateful for coming on again. And I'm really happy we were able to make some time to develop some of these other things. And the Mantella stuff was just, that was very enlightening. The tattooing study was, that's so ingenious. I love it.
I'll post a couple of pictures and on Insta and tag you in them so you can have a look. But yeah, it's kind of mad when you actually see them, especially when the frog's like 12 millimeters long, and you're trying to tattoo it. It requires some good glasses and some good head torches. But yeah, it's good fun.
I can only imagine. Ben, do you want to just give everybody the web address for the frog farm, if anybody's interested in getting frogs from you in the UK?
Yeah, check us out. It's www.fantasticfrogsuk. No, that's wrong. Fantasticfrogs.co.uk. That's it. Check us out on there, and then check us out at Fantastic Frogs UK on Instagram and Facebook. That's the one.
Awesome. Love this stuff. All right, everyone, again, I want to thank Ben for coming back on the show again, and we're going to have to do part three at some point, because now I've got more stuff to think about. I love this stuff. I love getting into topics and being able to develop them, and the more questions I have, the more stuff I have to ask. So, yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun. Ben's a great guest. It was my pleasure to have him on, and I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I will catch up with you again next time.